You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, as the presidential campaign reaches the final stretch, President Trump has been reaching out to suburban voters. We'll learn how his strategy relates to changes in housing policy. Now, possibly one of the most used icebreakers in a room or Zoom call full of new people is to ask everyone to share an interesting fact about themselves. Our next guest decided to flip the idea on its head, instead asking students to share a boring fact about themselves. We want to hear from you. Pretend it's your first day at whatever. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 and share a boring fact about yourself with us. That's 800-642-1234 with your boring fact about yourself. We reached out to our colleagues at Wisconsin Public Media. Here's a few boring things about them. Melissa Ingalls with Morning Edition says she dropped her phone into some apricot jam and now the speaker doesn't work anymore. Corey Hess, Milwaukee reporter, says, I hate beans, all beans. They make me sick to look at and think about. I want to talk more about that. And Stephanie Elkins, Morning Classics host, says, I eat plain M&Ms one at a time, standing them up on end between my back teeth and crunching down through the middle very slowly. David DeWill is the associate principal of the Capstone Scholars Program at the University of South Carolina. He tweeted about his boring facts activity last month. David, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, what flipped you around on this? Why did you ask students for a boring fact instead of an interesting fact?
Well, that's a great question. So our associate vice president for student housing, Dr. Kirsten Kennedy here at the university, sends a listserv each morning through the Chronicle of Higher Education, and you know, it shares some like fun highlights and news from around the country. And so there was a footnote about a year or so ago where someone had asked a similar question like this in one of their classes, and I just loved the idea of asking my freshman students on the first day of class to share a boring fact about themselves, because the class that I teach, University 101, you know, it's a national leader in the first year experience, and you know, we really try to build a tight knit community within the class. And I know, especially as an introvert, I just freeze whenever I have to answer an interesting question about myself. You know, there's a lot of pressure, especially if someone's like, I've traveled to all of the countries in Europe. How do you follow that up? I'm also, you know, a big fan of humor and authenticity. And so I find a lot of humor in kind of like the mundane and the quirks about people. So I decided to lead that class, my first class of the semester, off with this question about a boring fact to kind of take the pressure away. And it really did bring about a lot of just fantastically hilarious responses. So I started off myself saying, I do not like mayonnaise on things, especially sandwiches. You know, I know that I eat mayonnaise in things, but man, if you put mayonnaise on a sandwich, it immediately becomes a no to me. So that kind of got the ball rolling, and the students were able to share some really funny responses.
Well, to illustrate the concerns about that interesting question, here's a clip from our Wisconsin Life project talking about a narrator here waiting for his turn to share three interesting facts about himself. Here's a listen.
Now the kid in the polo shirt has only one more fact to go. Turns out he's passionate about dirt bikes. Why aren't you passionate about anything? He works in a joke and it gets a chuckle. At this point, you would give your soul for a chuckle.
So it's good to take some of that pressure off. But okay, so you ask students, you share your mayonnaise fact, and you ask your students, David, for their boring facts. What kind of things do you get from them? And is it maybe even more interesting?
Well, ironically, I think that became a lot more interesting than boring. The two that I tweeted about got a lot of attention, especially the student who shared that he likes to eat a pound of turkey a day. I feel like I had several follow-up questions that I wanted to ask the student.
Sam.
And, you know, for just if your listeners are curious, his go-to turkey is Boar's Head Oven Gold. And another student had shared that they like to put on both socks before their shoes, which is a quite, you know, normal thing to do. But some of the other really interesting ones, well, I guess interesting/boring, right? A student loves to eat their pizza crust first because they want to get that part of the pizza over with first.
I've done that, yeah.
One student said that they like to eat the perimeter of a sandwich first before eating the center. I had a student share that they loved air, as in breathing air, which I assume is a very good thing. And so there's another student. I know this is very focused on food. A student shared that they don't like to eat anything that has, you know, that's the color white, I guess like cream cheese or sour cream. And so we all had a really great laugh, especially the student who said that they did not like cats because it really upset the cat people in the class.
Like the creature, the cats, not the musical?
Correct. It could have been both. Who knows? But for sure the animal, yes.
Now, let's talk about the ultimate mission here. I mean, if you're doing an icebreaker like this, you're trying to break the ice, establish that comfort level with the room, whether it's a classroom or a work meeting or a training or whatever. Do you think that worked?
It did. After that first class and a lot of students afterwards just kind of laughed with each other. Based on some of the things that they shared, they started sharing more about themselves in our group message on GroupMe. And so it really opened the door to be authentic, and which is what I really want for in my class. I want students to be authentic with each other and to kind of break down those barriers. Especially on the first day of a college class, there's a lot of temptation to try to, you know, put on this image, I guess, to try to impress people. But when you just share very boring things about yourself, you kind of open up yourself to really show who you really are, which is super important, especially in my class with my first-year students.
Talking to David DeWille, Associate Principal of the Capstone Scholars Program at the University of South Carolina. He shared in a tweet that he had switched the old-fashioned classroom icebreaker, tell us something interesting about yourself, to something boring about yourself, and he got good results from it. Well, we asked you to share one of yours. We've got Ben in Chippewa Falls on the line. Ben, hi.
Hi there, Rob. Love your show. I'm a daily listener, and thank you so much for sharing this story. I saw it on social media. It's great. I brush my teeth in the shower every single time. We are regular people out here, and we all do boring stuff, and I thought, thank you so much for asking people this question. Thank you.
Well, hold on, Ben. I got to ask, when did you start? Was it like a Seinfeld thing where you're trying to be more efficient with your shower time, or just...
I think it probably was. I was trying to get ready for work in the mornings and just decided to start brushing my teeth in the shower. I've probably been doing this. I'm 41. I've been doing it for at least 20 years, and I don't have a plan to stop.
Excellent. Ben, thank you so much. And that's the perfect kind of... I'll throw boring in quotes, David, because it's, I guess, mundane but interesting.
It's so interesting, and I found myself laughing. I tried to cover up my phone just now, but my goodness, that one was great.
Yeah, so is this something you think you'll keep doing, asking for this boring thing, or do you think now that the word's out, the novelty's going to go away and it won't be fun anymore?
Oh, I plan to do this every year. I asked this question last year on the first day of class, this year on the first day of class, and it's definitely going to become a tradition of mine. It hits at everything that I want for that first day of class to be.
Well, David, thank you so much for sharing this with us. Really interesting.
Rob, thanks. I appreciate it.
That's David DeWille, Associate Principal of the Capstone Scholars Program at the University of South Carolina. He tweets at David DeWille, that's spelled DEWILL. We've got a link to some of his boring facts up at WPR.org/Central Time. Let's share a couple more from our colleagues here. Jeffrey Potter, Director of Marketing for WPR, says his boring thing is, I prefer to pay all my bills by mail with a paper check. Interesting. Jill Nato, Larry Miller Show producer, says, I always put salt on watermelon and will only eat it with a spoon. Dean Kallenbach, Senior Regional Manager of Western Wisconsin, says, I throw in right left-handed, but golf and bat right-handed. Interesting. Kathy Miner, a Simply Folk Music Library volunteer, says she reads her own sent emails. Here's mine. If I'm humming a song and walking, and there's always a song in my head, because of my marching band experience, the one of the beat always has to be on the left foot. And if I get it off, if I start on the wrong beat, I will do a little shuffle step to bring it into sync. That's my boring fact. Coming up, researchers recently solved a mystery surrounding massive clouds of gas swirling around our Milky Way galaxy. We'll learn more about these celestial objects coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about an interstellar mystery that was recently solved, in effect, by researchers around the world and here in Wisconsin. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story about a woman trying to prove the health of Milwaukee.
Cynthia Tejas Silva moved to the United States from Mexico on her 12th birthday. Her family eventually settled in Janesville, where she went to high school. Now, Tejas Silva works at 16th Street Community Health Centers in Milwaukee as the Healthy Schools Program Coordinator. Her long-term goal? To make the city healthier for everyone. Her story is being featured in the Wisconsin Humanities Traveling Exhibit, Immigrant Journeys from South of the Border. I recently caught up with Tejas Silva at South Shore Park in Milwaukee, where she told me more about her job.
So in my day-to-day job right now, I do a lot of different videos, and I've been taking on a special project called Explorando Milwaukee, or Exploring Milwaukee, that aims to highlight a lot of the different green areas, trails, hidden spots where people can go and either walk to or exercise in, or simply have a picnic at, like in South Shore Park.
Hola amigos, bienvenidos a Explorando Milwaukee. Y hoy nos encontramos en el Parque South Shore.
Then the other ones is really helping support the Latinos por la Salud Facebook page. It's a group that the clinic and our community supports. It's made out of residents. And they have been taking on a project of cooking and showing these recipes on our website.
El día de hoy les voy a preparar una deliciosa sopa de tortilla con ingredientes.
Also, walking clubs and biking clubs. I'm very fond of those because on Wednesdays I get to ride with a lot of teenagers, youth from the community who come and are just ready to ride along. So we've been discovering different senderos, different trails like the Kinikinik. Once I see people that I haven't seen there come, and then you see more people becoming aware of like, oh, I didn't know this place was here and I've been living here like my whole life. It's like, yeah, and you know, and now I've been hearing some of these people speak Spanish a lot around me more than before, so I think that's a good sign that people are, you know, trying to get out there more.
Ahora sí vamos a seguir con Josmari disfrutando de la fiesta de aquí de Latinos por la Salud.
All of that to say that it's a very multi-dynamic job that I do, and I love it. It keeps me grounded, it keeps me in shape, which is great, and it keeps me healthy. So I always knew I wanted to be in a community health setting. I had a heart murmur when I was in high school. The only reason why I knew was because I had to get a physical done in order to join the soccer team. And there that was. And being in Janesville, I didn't see like another Latina woman, for example, like talking to me or to my mom, explaining. I was like, okay, there's an exam that needs to be done. Okay, we got to get the exam done. I don't know what that exam is for, but... So I think sometimes seeing the lack of explanation in some cases, and I think sometimes that includes like the language, it kind of made me aware of, hey, we need more people, you know, doing this. I think there's a lot of social change around us, and I say, what within my job or within my power, essentially, can I do to change systems, and how do we transform systems? I think my purpose is really to look at the health of a community or of the city, in this case Milwaukee. I mean, I love Milwaukee. I'm very appreciative of everything that it has given me, but I also know that there's so much work to do. That's a dream job for me right now, and I think that has amplified my idea of what the health of the community looks like, because now I'm not just looking at the community on the south side, but I'm looking at the whole city, and I think that has prompted me a little bit more thinking into, okay, what's next? I don't know. So, but I'm hopeful.
That was Cynthia Tejas Silva of Milwaukee. She's the Healthy Schools Program Coordinator at 16th Street Community Health Centers. Her story is also being featured in the Wisconsin Humanities Exhibit, Immigrant Journeys from South of the Border. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
The Wisconsin Humanities exhibit, Immigrant Journeys from South of the Border, will be in Beloit and Rice Lake this month. Now, our galaxy and our universe are home to a great number of celestial bodies, some of which we have a pretty okay handle on, your planets and stars. But some phenomena are a little bit weirder and have stumped astronomers and physicists for a long time. One of those is an interstellar halo around a couple of galaxies near our very own Milky Way. The Magellanic Stream has been a bit of a mystery until now. New research from UW-Madison and partners around the globe have given a possible answer to the mystery of the Magellanic Stream. Scott Lucchini is a doctoral student in the UW-Madison Physics Department, part of this research. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we need to start with a little bit of intergalactic geography. We've got the Milky Way, our pretty good-sized galaxy, but we've got some little guys between us. Tell us about the Magellanic Cloud galaxies.
That's right. So these guys are pretty small. They're about 10% the size of the Milky Way, but they're actually pretty close as well. They're, I mean, relatively speaking, they're about 150,000 light years away from us. So they're nearby, and that means we can get a pretty good look at them as well.
And then we've got this Magellanic Stream. What is that?
So that's the remnant of the interactions between these two galaxies. So there's the small and the large Magellanic Clouds, two different galaxies that have been interacting with each other, swirling around each other for a very long time, 5 to 10 billion years. And throughout that time, the gas that was once inside those galaxies has been pulled out. And that's now what we call the Magellanic Stream.
So literally the gravity, I guess, the net gravity of the two galaxies, or three galaxies, I guess, is pulling stuff, the lining out from them?
That's exactly right. Yeah, we call it tidal forces. So as they orbit around each other, the gas gets hurled out of them.
On a huge scale. The galaxies are big, if I can put this in technical terms.
Right, yeah. Well, the total mass of this stream is about 2 billion times the mass of our sun. So it's absolutely huge.
Now, and that's part of the mystery. If I'm reading things right, this stream was bigger than we thought it should be. Is that right?
Well, right. The observations, we knew that it was this big from observations that have been made over the past 10 years or so. But the simulations that were trying to figure out where this came from couldn't account for all of that mass. It only got about 10% of it right. And so that's where we come in. This new paper that we've published finds that missing piece.
All right. So what is the missing piece? That's most of it. What could this missing piece have been?
The large Magellanic Cloud is actually bigger than we thought in previous studies, it wasn't quite as large. Since it's so big, we've included more gas around the outside of that galaxy as well. So it has some gas on the inside of it, and then a big sphere of gas around it as well. And this sphere of gas is hot, and it hasn't been accounted for before. So based on the new observations that suggested it should exist, we ran our simulations with this new cloud, this new sphere of gas. And it turns out that gas ends up being stripped just like the gas on the inside and forms all of this hot gas in the stream, which was the bulk of it.
Interesting. Now, so these observations helped you build this simulation up. Now, do we make more observations to kind of put your new simulations to the test?
That's exactly right. So we think that if this big sphere of gas used to exist, it would explain the mass of the Magellanic Stream, but there would also be bits of it that we could still see. There have already been some observations that hint at it, but the next step would be going out with our telescopes and specifically looking for this hot gas or what's left of it today.
How much of this is possible exclusively, I guess, because of orbital telescopes as opposed to ground-based one? Have those been part of what's been able to help us observe this stuff in the first place?
Yeah, so that's been a big part. I'm not sure when it was installed, but somewhere in the last 10 years, the Cosmic Origins Spectrograph was installed on the Hubble Space Telescope. Of course, we've all heard about Hubble for decades upon decades. It's very famous. But this new machine was installed recently, and it has proven very useful in measuring a lot of these properties of the Magellanic Stream. And that one's out in space, obviously. So a lot of the measurements that it does, we can't do from the ground.
Now, this is in our local neighborhood, Milky Way, and some of these smaller galaxies are kind of caught up in the general area. Does gaining an understanding of this now help us maybe understand similar clusters of galaxies further out there?
That's exactly right. So since this is so close to us, we get such a good view, and we're able to make such good observations of what it actually looks like, so we get a better understanding. And then when we see this out in other galaxies or other clusters, as you say, we'll be able to relate it back to what we see here and really have a better understanding of what's going on out there.
As I talk about this, you know, I'm picturing kind of scale models of galaxies here. Do you ever just get overwhelmed with the sense of scale of the hugeness of the things that you're studying here?
Oh, it's mind-boggling. Ever since I started learning about this stuff in college, I've tried to come up with ways to relate billions and trillions of things to everyday life, and it's just impossible. You just have to put it in a separate box.
Does that make it hard to explain to lay people like me?
Well, yeah, it's tough to give that that tangible something you can hold on to, but hopefully the mind-bogglingness of it gives it a sense of wonder in and of itself.
So what's next for you and the people you work with on things like interactions between galaxies, just in our last 30 seconds or so?
Sure, yeah. We want to keep digging into the study of this Magellanic Stream. We hope to run more simulations with more physics and higher resolution so that we can really dig into some of the details that we haven't seen before.
Scott, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thanks so much.
Scott Lucchini is a doctoral student in the University of Wisconsin-Madison Physics Department. He joined us today to talk about research he and colleagues around the world did on a mysterious galactic halo in some of the smaller galactic neighbors to our own Milky Way galaxy. It's a big neighborhood. Coming up, President Trump has changed a federal housing rule, saying the change will, quote, protect the suburbs. We'll talk to a Wisconsin reporter about how the message relates to Fair Housing Act rules meant to end discrimination in local housing policies. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the mental health risks facing police officers and efforts to provide treatment and prevent suicide in law enforcement. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, suburban voters often get a lot of attention during election season. This year's presidential campaign is no different. President Trump has tweeted that he will protect the suburbs and claims his opponent, former Vice President Joe Biden, would abolish them. Our guest has been digging into how the claim is rooted in rule changes made to enforcement of the Fair Housing Act. Tom Dakin is a business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, pleasure to be here.
You recently wrote a piece looking into a lot of elements of the Fair Housing Act and an enforcement change under the Obama administration. Can you give us some of the background on the Fair Housing Act and how it was enforced?
Right. Well, this has its roots in a rule that was issued in 2015 by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development during President Barack Obama's second term. And that rule is known as Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing, or AFFH, since Washington, D.C. loves putting letters together. It was designed to require communities to more effectively enforce the Fair Housing Act. And that's a law that was passed in 1968. Most people are familiar with it in that it protects you from discrimination based on race, sex, other things when you're seeking to rent or buy a home or obtain a mortgage. But the Fair Housing Act also requires communities that receive HUD community development grants and other funds to take significant actions to overcome historic patterns of racial segregation. And this rule was issued during the Obama administration because previous attempts to enforce that provision of the Fair Housing Act really weren't very effective. Before we had this rule, communities had to do an analysis of barriers to fair housing, But that analysis really didn't involve any kind of review by HUD. And under the new rule, communities that took the money from HUD were required to do more detailed assessments using data provided by HUD on segregated living patterns, racially concentrated areas of poverty, things like that. And the idea was to require those communities to better consider fair housing issues, such as segregation, identify the factors behind those issues, and then establish some fair housing goals. And the agency also would do a review of those community assessments and those goals. And then we had a change of presidents, and under Trump, HUD took a different approach.
Yeah, talk about the changes under the Trump administration to how fair housing rules were enforced.
Well, first of all, in 2018, HUD withdrew a computer tool that local governments were required to use in preparing those assessments. HUD claimed that the tool was hard to use and was producing some unacceptable results. And then in January of this year, the agency said it would revise that rule. It said it would require communities to take what it called concrete steps over a course of 5 years to further fair housing, and would take into account the what it called the unique needs and difficulties of those communities. But then that proposal was revised even further after President Trump questioned whether it would do enough to reduce what he considered to be federal control of local housing decisions. And the new rule issued in July that replaced the Obama-era rule, the new rule called Preserving Community and Housing Choice, simply requires communities to kind of make a general commitment that they use HUD funds to take active steps to promote fair housing. So the requirement of doing these detailed assessments that would be reviewed by the agency, that was gone completely.
So that means no real enforcement then, it sounds like, if I'm hearing you right.
Well, that's certainly what the fair housing advocates who were in favor of the Obama era rule would claim, and they seem to be claiming it with a fair amount of justification. There don't appear to be any detailed enforcement rules linked to this new rule, and essentially, it does seem to give communities a lot more leeway than they would have otherwise had under the Obama era rule.
We're talking to Tom Dakin, business reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about the Fair Housing Act, changes in enforcement under the Obama administration, and then kind of back under the Trump administration, and the politics and how this fits into the presidential race. And to that end, Tom, I want to give a listen to President Trump talking to reporters before boarding Marine One on July 31st. Here's some of what he had to say about Fair Housing Act enforcement.
So we ended a rule that was a very horrible rule for people in suburbia, in the suburbs. And that rule has been a very unfair rule for a long time. And it was going to be made a lot worse by Biden and Cory Booker. It's a rule that basically you build low-income housing and you build other forms of housing, also having to do with zoning, and destroy people that have lived in communities in suburbia. For years they've lived there, and they want to destroy their lives and destroy what they have.
So a lot of particular claims here. Under the Obama-era rules, had that happened, the federal government forcing a lot of communities to change their zoning to allow low-income housing in suburban areas?
No, it hadn't. Well, the rule, for one thing, was barely in enforcement before the Trump administration came in and changed it. The claims are that, I mean, his suggestion there by Trump essentially is that rule mandated low-income housing in the suburbs, and that suggestion simply isn't accurate. This has been something that has been fact-checked by numerous organizations. Factcheck.org in particular is one that sticks out. Anybody who wants to read the rule, it's fairly voluminous, will find that it does not impose any kind of land use decisions or zoning laws on local governments. Now, the people who are opposed to the rule do try and make the case that because there was an effort to get communities to do these meaningful assessments of their housing patterns, whether they're segregated, and that those assessments included recommendations to combat that, that in effect would take away local zoning decision from those communities. That's the argument they make. HUD points out, though, that there's nothing in the rule that requires any changes, that this is simply an attempt to get communities to consider these challenges to segregated housing and figure out ways to remedy that. And in some cases, perhaps that would involve a community concluding that, yes, it should do some type of zoning change. But again, that would be up to the community, not up to HUD to make those decisions.
So here, the president saying this rule would destroy suburbs. He is quoted elsewhere as saying the suburb destruction will end with us, and has accused former Vice President Joe Biden of planning to abolish the suburbs. How have people been reading this as political messaging versus the actual, fine print of the actual laws and rules involved here?
Well, I think the political messaging is pretty apparent, and that comes from the president himself. He posted a July 23rd tweet for what he referred to, quote, the suburban housewives of America, unquote. I think that's pretty apparent who his audience is. And in that tweet, he said, Biden will destroy your neighborhood and your American dream. And it was a reference to this rule change that his administration was unveiling to reverse the Obama administration's rule.
I want to bring this home a little bit. You've written about development in the Milwaukee area a lot over the years, and we know that Milwaukee and other parts of Wisconsin are, by some measure, some of the most segregated in the United States. Has mm-hmm. the Fair Housing Act done much in communities like Milwaukee?
Well, arguably within the Milwaukee metropolitan area, and that's really the way that we need to look at this. We need to look at Milwaukee and the communities that are in the same area. I don't think it's done a lot. Certainly enforcement of it is a good thing when it's done too. Obviously, I don't think anybody out there, I would hope, doesn't believe in racial discrimination when it comes to housing. But as you point out, we are still a very racially segregated metropolitan area. And again, the fair housing advocates and the people who favor this rule would argue that the AFFH rule that the Obama administration posted in 2015 was kind of a long overdue step. I mean, the Fair Housing Act was passed in 1968. So this is a rule that's coming basically, two generations later? And even that was difficult to enforce because the current administration essentially stripped it away.
And can you talk about maybe some of what led to the creation of this law? There was very overt housing discrimination, right, in many communities as late as the late 1960s. That's part of what led to the original Fair Housing Act, right?
Well, right. The history, of course, including in Milwaukee, is we had a considerable amount of protest against segregated housing, against racial discrimination when it comes to renting and buying homes. And that's what led to that piece of legislation. Really, the last major legislation combating racial discrimination of the 1960s. You would have had the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and then Fair Housing Act in 1968. And again, as a tool to enforce against racial desegregation, it's had some positive results. But gosh, I'd point out that as late as 2015, one of the largest HUD-initiated settlements of redlining claims was against Associated Bank in Wisconsin for alleged racial discrimination that the bank did in providing mortgages in Milwaukee and other urban markets. And that was in 2015. Now, Associated Bank, in settling that claim, made no admission of wrongdoing, but it did agree to provide a large fund for mortgages and other housing assistance in some of those lower income areas where the discrimination allegedly occurred.
Talking to Tom Dakin, business reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at enforcement changes under the Fair Housing Act in the Obama and Trump administrations and how it's all being used in political messaging, especially to suburban voters. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you one of those suburban voters? What do you think of the president's messages directed to you about enforcement of fair housing laws, anti-discrimination laws, accusations that the president's opponent is working to abolish the suburbs? Have you followed changes in fair housing rules over the years? Were you one of the protesters that Tom had mentioned earlier back in the day? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about changes to fair housing rules at the federal level and how it's all factoring into political messaging in the presidential race. Tom Dakin is with us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of what you hear from the president when it comes to suburban voters and housing policies, his accusations that Joe Biden would abolish the suburbs if elected? Do you have questions about how fair housing policy works, how it's changed in terms of enforcement between the Obama and Trump administrations? If you are watching all this from the suburbs, what do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Was there, Tom, I guess, a constituency among local governments who were saying, hey, the feds are stepping on our toes when it comes to what we could do with housing policy?
I mean, I think there's certainly some opposition to that 2015 Obama administration rule that the Trump administration suspended from people in local governments who felt it was federal overreach, who also felt that the rule would be difficult and expensive for local governments to comply with if they had to do these annual assessments. I think HUD's response to that essentially was twofold. Number one, we're enforcing this rule because you're taking money from us. Okay. I mean, if you take community development block grants and other funds from HUD, I don't think it's completely unreasonable for HUD to expect some review of how you are doing in terms of enforcing the Fair Housing Act. I think the other response from HUD has been to say, look, again, we're not trying to make zoning decisions for you. We're trying to get you to make zoning decisions to the local communities. We're trying to get you to take a good, hard look at your community, whether there are barriers here that exists to having racially integrated housing, and whether some of those barriers do include zoning and land use decisions, and whether perhaps some of those zoning and be changed. Now, again, I suppose from the perspective of the people opposed to the rule, they would argue that essentially is local control without saying the words local control. But again, the rule doesn't say we're going to make these decisions for you. The rule is simply designed to have these annual assessments and get communities to really think about what they're doing and what they could be doing differently. I would say this, that when the Trump administration rolled out its rule in late July, and they call their rule Preserving Community and Neighborhood Choice, it was a 57-page document, and it cited one specific case to back up its claim that HUD had used Fair Housing Act to engage in local control. And that was a decision by the Obama administration HUD to negotiate the settlement of a lawsuit in 2009 that forced Westchester County, New York — this is the county that's just north of the city of New York — to change its zoning laws and pass legislation requiring landlords there to accept tenants using Section 8 housing vouchers. So that's one example in a 57-page document that it cited to back up that claim of overreach. Honestly, you would have thought that if you're going to make a broad claim like that, perhaps you'd have other examples.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Edward is with us in Madison. Edward, hi. Nope, Edward's not there anymore. Thanks, Edward, for calling in. Let's bring on Steve with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It's actually interesting hearing the different political angles on this issue when really at the end of the day, the biggest problems facing people of color in certain areas is really job opportunities and learning a skill that can provide life-supporting wages. And, from a discrimination standpoint, sure, there's some discrimination that's out there, but that is not the number one issue facing the community. You have to develop skills that people want to pay for, and then you don't have to worry about the discrimination.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. At least historically, Tom, a black person and a white person who had the same income couldn't necessarily buy the same house, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And I'm not going to disagree that obviously, whether you're black, white, whatever your race is, having education, having skills in order to have a livelihood, to buy a house where you want or rent an apartment where you want is important. But that doesn't discount the actual documented discrimination we've seen over the years when we have, for example, testing of landlords, and a fair housing organization will send in a black person, a white person with similar income levels, similar background of education, and they will find often, or at least sometimes, that the apartment is available for the white person, not available for the black person. I mean, you can't ignore the reality of those things. I would also say, frankly, as a white person, I'm not going to get into telling a black person what is or is not the greatest challenges that they face.
Thanks for calling in, Steve, at 800-642-1234. Tom Dakin is with us, business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel, talking about the federal Fair Housing Act, discrimination and changes from the Obama administration to the Trump administration and how it gets enforced. Back to your calls. Elizabeth is with us in Lancaster. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. I was listening in and recalling back to my government class back in high school. I know that redlining laws were outlawed in most states because both parties were taking advantage of communities that weren't very diverse. I was curious with the Equal Housing Act and how you mentioned that there isn't very diverse housing, a lot of different people living in Milwaukee. Is it kind of reinforcing redlining laws, even though we can't technically call it that?
Elizabeth, thanks for the call. So, Tom, I think even if there's not active redlining, once it was in place, is it hard, I guess, to get out of that segregated neighborhood?
Well, yeah. Let's look at the history here, and I'm glad your caller brought this up. We've had, first of all, redlining. For those not familiar with the term, it has its origins literally in the practice in which maps were drawn, with certain areas drawn in red ink, in which you would not have loans, home mortgage loans. In the 1930s, when the Fair Housing Administration was created to provide what we now know as mortgage insurance, that, of course, happened under the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a Democrat, and it was supported in Congress by both Democrats and Republicans. And that redlining occurred for decades before it was essentially outlawed by the Fair Housing Act in 1968. But as I alluded to earlier, as late as, 2015 here in Wisconsin, with Associated Bank settling the complaint by HUD. And again, I should say Associated Bank admitted to no wrongdoing in settling the complaint, but they did agree to provide a large fund for loans in areas where HUD alleged they had been discriminated against people on the basis of race. So yeah, it's really difficult to unwind decades of discrimination, and it's unfortunately really difficult for black people to catch up with white people with the well-documented wealth gap that occurs in this country when the home ownership rate among black people is so much lower compared to white people. And that gap is particularly acute in the Milwaukee area.
Thanks for that call, Elizabeth. Tom, in our last minute or so, you wrote a piece, Five Things You Should Know About the Suburban Destruction Claim. What are you watching for next on this policy and as people talk about it during the presidential campaign?
Well, as far as the policy goes, I mean, the rule is the rule. The Trump administration promulgated it in July. And as for now, essentially, communities do not have to do what the Obama administration was requiring them to do. However, communities could still opt to do this if they wanted to. And I believe, for example, the city of Milwaukee, which is in a consortium with some of the communities in the Milwaukee area, I think it's Milwaukee, West Dallas, and Wauwatosa, if I remember correctly, I believe they're going to choose to still go ahead and do their assessment of their communities. And when that assessment is produced, it will obviously make for stories by the Journal Sentinel, and I hope other news media as well, as to what they find in their housing patterns and what remedies they suggest to better integrate those communities.
And we'll watch for that. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Tom Dakin is a business reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked with us today about his reporting on changes in federal fair housing rules and how they're factoring into the presidential campaign messaging. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, a lot of students are learning online from kindergarten through college, and instructors are looking for new tools. Kate talks to an expert in the use of video games and virtual reality for education. Find out more tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Up next, organized labor has traditionally been aligned with the Democratic Party. Our guests signed an open letter that encourages conservatives to reach out to the labor movement. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.